Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is Julie.
Hi, I'm Julie Frederick. I'm a reader of science fiction and fantasy, and I kind of get gleeful about all the existential philosophical elements in them. That's my favorite.
Hey, I'm Nick. My wife wrote my bio, so it's always interesting to see what she says. Apparently, I'm a library builder, a BYU professor, and a fan of many things pop culture.
And I'm Kwaylee Wetton. I write fantasy. I'm a former teacher, current yoga teacher, and I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. And we are recording live at Dragonsteel 2022. Woo! We are here for the launch of The Lost Metal, the latest book in Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn series. Now, normally on this podcast, we take mainstream pop culture and get our Mormonism all over it. But today, we are going to take a speculative fiction series authored by a member of the LDS Church and talk about the echoes of Mormonism that we see in these books. We're specifically going to be focusing on LDS Connections in the Wax and Wane series today. No spoilers for Lost Metal, but we will be liberally spoiling all the other Mistborn books, including Secret History, so you've been warned, turn it off now. But first, we do our best book segment, where we each recommend something we are watching, reading, or listening. My recommendation today, I just finished my reread of the Penric and Desdemona series by Lois McMaster Bujold. If you enjoy the speculative theology in Brandon's works, I think you will really like Penric and Desdemona. They play a lot with gender roles and a very rule-based magic system reminiscent of Brandon's stuff. The author describes them as a speculative theological mystery. So quite enjoyable and very similar to the things we're going to be talking about today.
That sounds like something I definitely need to read. I just read Sarah Moss's Throne of Glass. It's the first I've read of hers, and that's the one I just finished most recently, and I enjoyed it.
I'll give a shout-out to Stephen King's Fairy Tale. King can be good or miss for me, but if you enjoy Portal Fantasy, if you enjoy The Talisman, it's not 112263, which is one of the greatest books ever written. But yeah, if you're a fan of King's kind of slant towards fantasy, it was pretty good.
My shout-out today is for Bone Crier's Moon. It's from Catherine Purdy. She shows up at a lot of conventions, and I really enjoyed hearing about her book, and so I recently read it. It was really good, particularly the way that she handles cultural differences between the normal world and a society of people called the Bone Criers. So that was really fun to watch that tension build out.
Awesome. Thanks for those recommendations. And now we're going to move on to our main event, talking about Mormonism in the Mistborn series. Nick, we wanted to start with a little disclaimer talking about authorial intent. Is Brandon Sanderson trying to convert everybody with his books?
Yeah, this is a big deal for me. When Brandon Sanderson comes up in my classes, I teach New Testament Book of Mormon classes at BYU. And so his stuff comes up from time to time in my class. And a lot of the times the question students will ask is it intentional, right? Is he trying to work Latter-day Saint themes into his work, or is he just a byproduct of who he is as a Latter-day Saint? And so last year at this convention, which was much smaller, I was quite surprised when I got here this morning at 9:25 and had to stand in line. But I asked him about this, and I brought up things like, well, what about stuff written on metal? Is that based on the gold plates? Or the opposition of ruin and preservation, 2 Nephi 2, feels like it's echoing what's going on with Jacob there. And he said, oh, that's not really intentional at all. The one thing he did say was intentional was King Benjamin and Dalinar. That was an intentional connection he was trying to make in modeling Nohadon and Dalinar in the Way of Kings after King Benjamin's speech in the Book of Mormon. And so this is a topic that Brandon himself has talked about. He does admit there are echoes of Latter-day Saint scripture and tradition in his work. I'm all about the death of the author. I'm all about avoiding authorial intent. Julia Kristeva and her idea of that all literature is a mosaic of a quotation. I'm all about that. But here we have a chance to look at an author who's a Latter-day Saint who admits, yeah, Latter-day Saint stuff comes into my work, comes into my corpus, not necessarily always explicitly, but it's, I think it allows us a chance to dig in, and we can ask ourselves, is it intentional, is it not intentional? But the fact that he broaches it, I think allows a forum like this to exist where we can talk about Latter-day Saint themes in his work. But I will say, again, with the nod to Liz here, that just because it's the author's intent or not his intent doesn't mean we have to judge the work by those standards.
But I also want to mention that authorial intent, it doesn't give you fewer interpretive options, it gives you more. So it's just one more part of the mosaic. So I hate to just discount it, especially if the author has put something out there. So it's fun to see what is intentional and what isn't.
Maybe just read that sentence.
Oh, and this is the quote from Brandon Sanderson. He says, there are going to be LDS parallels in my books. I don't seek to expunge them. They are part of who I am. If I'm researching into mythology and history for my foundations, I'm going to dip into LDS sources more often than others. So the parallels that you are seeing are real things. Most likely, though, it's not intentional allegory.
Right. 2 years ago, I wrote a paper on the Mormon symbolism in the Stormlight Archive. And I found this really interesting quote from a special Writing Excuses episode that they recorded for Mormon Artist, where he says, he doesn't go into his work actively making any aspect of it LDS, but if you look at who I am and what my mythology is, what my belief in how things work is, influences what I do write when I write. And so I end up making these fantasy worlds that do have some core underlying LDS style mythology. So I would say he's not trying to do what C.S. Lewis did, right, and rewrite, here's the crucifixion story in a fantasy setting, here's the last battle of the second coming of Christ in a fantasy setting. But I think his work is much more close to things like The Silver Chair, where it's not retelling anything in particular, but it is dealing with themes that are very important to LDS people that have a lot to do with our interests in our theology that make us a little different from everyone else. So we already pointed out a few of the Mormon hat tips that we see in Mistborn, most importantly, metal plates. I just think that one stands out to every Mormon reader that I've spoken to. Does anyone else want to comment on one that they've seen? Just, I call them Mormon hat tips because they're just like little throwaway things that don't matter as much, and then we'll get to more of the underlying, more important themes that we see that are related to LDS theology. Anyone want to bring one up?
Can I just say something on?
Yeah.
For me, the writing on metal plates seems to be a really big one for Brandon. You see this as early as Elantris. There's this kind of distrust in history, right? When Serene and Rayodin are researching records and realizing that the way history's been presented hasn't always been fair. Then this really, you see this with Yasna in the Stormlight Archives, right? With when they are able to transcribe the Aelis Dili, and they see that the humans are void bringers and things like that. And all of a sudden, all the history they thought they knew completely turns on its head. At the end of Well of Ascension, right, you have this really poignant moment where Sazed realizes that the reason Elendi's not supposed to go to the Well of Ascension is not because he's going to grab the power, because it allows Ruin to escape. And it's just this crushing moment for him. And I don't know if this is Brandon's kind of way of playing with an unreliable narrator trope, but to me, again, as a reader of the Book of Mormon, this feels like it's right out of 1 Nephi 13. There's going to be a religious organization that intentionally corrupts Scripture. And the only thing you can trust is stuff written on metal, which is the Book of Mormon in our culture. And so it's just, to me, that's a very clear echo.
One other little hat tip, I just noticed that the earliest Christians are called followers of the way, and the fact that people who follow harmony are Pathians. I just think that's fun, the idea that we all have to find a journey, find a path, find a way that matters to us, and the journey makes us who we are.
For sure. And you also mentioned about the opposition between ruin and preservation, and this idea of opposition in all things is also one. Another interesting one is when in Secret History we see preservation weeping over the state of the creation that he's made. That reminds us a lot of Moses 7, where we have Enoch talking with God. What more could I have done for my creation? See what they're doing to each other and how horrible it is.
I mean, just theologically, that's fascinating, because Terrell Givens and Fiona Givens wrote this really interesting book called The God Who Weeps, right? This idea that the Mormon God is unique because he feels emotions, right? He cries, he weeps, he feels pain. And then, in Mistborn Secret History, when Kelsier's looking at preservation, and he feels it, what Sanderson calls a divine agony, right? The sense that he's feeling the pain of every soul on the planet. And again, that's a little bit removed from the God without body parts and passion. I think as a Latter-day Saint, you look at preservation and say, there's echoes of my deity in the way that preservation is responding to the pain that he sees.
For sure. And I think that kind of takes us into the more theological themes. I think a lot of what we see from Harmony in the second Mistborn series is playing with LDS ideas of God. One of the things that I think makes Mormonism different from other branches of Christianity is this recognition that God is limited by rules. Like we have 2 Nephi 2, like you said, if these rules cease to be, then God ceases to be God. And so in some ways, the Mormon perception of God is as someone who is bound by rules, which is different. And we see that play out with Sazed and how hard it is for him to play within his own rules and allow people freedom while still influencing things. Any thoughts on that?
Kweli, what are your favorite parts from Say Zed?
Particularly in relation to how he's trying to manipulate things the best that he can to create or to keep the world going the way that it should be. I think the most poignant moment for me when I looked back at reading The Second Mistborn is when we find out about Lessie's death and how it was all orchestrated. And it brings up an interesting point for me with the LDS discussions on agency versus foreordination, because in this case, it was very manipulated to get Wax into the place that he needed to be, but then at the same time, he still had to make choices along the way. And so I think that was one of the things that caused me to ponder the most about what was the intent there and like what, how does that relate to my own personal.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, you brought up in our show notes, you talked about the problem of theodicy, which is where this is going. If God can make bad things turn for good, does that mean God is causing bad things to happen? And we see Wax struggling with this a lot in Bands of Mourning.
Yeah, and he has that really poignant discussion with Harmony where Harmony says, where should I draw the line? And Wax says, well, yeah, no murder. You shouldn't, yeah, probably not killing innocents. And Harmony says, how do you know? I haven't already drawn the line. And you just can't recognize it because you've never seen a bigger picture. And anyone who's read Mistborn 1 can look at it and be like, oh yeah, like Wax's life, Wayne's life, everybody in Era 2 is living a better life than any Ska in Mistborn 1. But Harmony still has to decide, how much suffering do I allow? And that's a question of theodicy, Theo meaning God and DK meaning justice. How can God be fair when people suffer? When you suffer from other people's decisions. And that's one of the most interesting things, I think, about free will, is the idea that we, as a culture, just Western culture generally, we desperately want to propagate the idea of free will is the right option, which is great, but we have a hard time admitting that every time one person makes a choice, anyone who has a relationship with them has more limited choices. Anytime I make a choice about my schedule or what I'm going to do, it changes Nick's choices. Anytime he makes a choice about his schedule, our children make choices. Every time we make a so-called free choice, we are actually limiting other people's choices. And I think that's what we see play out, especially with Lessie and Wax, that Lessie's choice to not push Wax back changed Harmony's choices. And Harmony's choices to take her out of the running because he needed Wax back changed Wax's choices. And so this wonderful difficulty of, I get to choose, but I don't get to choose my choices. The choices I have to choose from are entirely constructed by the relationships around me. And I think everybody deals with that. And I think that's what Jacob and Lehi are dealing with. The choices of his brother, and if you look at 2 Nephi 2, 1 through 2, I know we've come back to it like 12 times, but
it's an important one.
Yeah, it's amazing because Lehi starts out this discussion of the fall is necessary because we need opposition and we need choices. But he starts the discussion saying, Jacob, you've suffered because of someone else's decisions. You've suffered because of the rudeness of your brother, and you've suffered because you're a kid in the wilderness, and these were the years of my tribulation. You've experienced suffering that had nothing to do with your choices. So what choice actually matters? And I think that's what, same thing we get to Wax at the end, like, you don't actually get that many choices. There's so many choices that are limited by your circumstance. You kind of only get one choice, and that's what Wax has to deal with at the end of Bands of Mourning.
I think that's another interesting element of Brandon's work here, is as Latter-day Saints, we have a view of God that's infallible, right? But yet there's still this idea of progression, and we kind of work in this kind of gray area as far as what exaltation actually means. And as Wax and Harmony are having these discussions, and Harmony admits he's fallible, and Harmony says, I don't know everything. And Wax says, that's what frightens me, right? And I've met Latter-day Saints who, their trust, their confidence in God, this idea of progression, they're wondering, does God have a full awareness of everything? When I suffer, and I tell myself it's because that's what God wants me to do, am I assuming an omniscience there that doesn't actually exist because God himself is still progressing? That's this, again, this messy element we add with a God who just doesn't stand above us all, this omniscient, omnipotent, but is like us continuing his own journey.
Along with that, if you think of that moment in the carriage that Wax first actually talks directly to Harmony, and Harmony says, I still make a lot of mistakes. Is that a problem for you? And at that point, Wax says, no, that's not a problem for me. You never claimed to be infallible, so it's okay. But I love the irony that moment creates with the end of Shadows of Self, because Wax realizes that If he considers it Harmony making a mistake by letting him kill Lessie, now it really matters a lot. The choices that Harmony makes that change the choices Wax had. That at the beginning of the book, Wax is perfectly happy to say, yeah, it's okay, we all make mistakes. But then when something that he perceives as a mistake costs him suffering, then this question of theodicy, is this okay? Is it okay for God to let us suffer or even set it up knowing he's not maybe causing the suffering, but he knows very well that the suffering is going to happen, it is going to be experienced.
There's this great scene at the ends of Shadows of Self with Mercy and Wax, right? Where this line, what good is a God like that? Tell me that. Why should I invest in a God who either knows everything and allows me to suffer or doesn't know everything? Where am I supposed to put my faith? That's the disciples' journey. And man, you can see Wax following this all the way through. It's a really poignant journey.
And this is another element that you see with the multiplicity of deities throughout Sanderson's work. We talked about preservation weeping, but you also get a feel here for Harmony's suffering, that the value of a God who allows suffering isn't that he could stop it or would stop it or should stop it. The value of the God is that he's willing to suffer with you. And so this back to this idea of the God who's willing to weep with you because he knows you need to progress. And as Harmony says to Wax, I'm sorry you suffered, but I'm not sorry I did it. And it comes back to this very Christian and even more so Alma 7 look at the value of a God who maybe doesn't do things the way you want is that he's willing to walk the path with you while you're suffering.
And I think this kind of brings us back to thinking of Sazed and Harmony as a character. I think a lot of Brandon's work explores what happens when ordinary people become gods, which is at its heart a very Mormon question, because that's a belief that we have that eventually we can become as God is, right? As man now is, God once was. And so I feel like a lot of Brandon's work talks about this problem of how do we deal with it when we are given divine power? What do we do with it? How does it change us? And how can we cope with that? Like really confronting this issue that's far off in Mormon theology, but you're able to bring it right to the forefront because you're doing fantasy.
Along those lines, I just think it's interesting to consider how, going back to authorial intent, it's like this is such a unique Mormon belief that it comes across as fantasy really easily. And so a lot of people can't or don't notice these things because it's not part of their belief system. And I think it's really cool that you can manipulate things in that way to where it's hidden. But if you're in that culture, then you're aware of that as well.
Yeah, I do a lot of research into Mormons in science fiction and fantasy, and there are some good essays by, I think, Terrell Givens has one. There's one by Orson Scott Card talking about Mormonism as a science fiction, fantasy-prone religion because of the belief in people becoming gods, the belief in, oh, we believe God has children on other worlds. We have no problem with aliens. It's like a very common theme in Mormon science fiction to talk about how the gospel will adapt to people on other planets. And I definitely also think the theme of agency has made a lot of Mormon writers very strong writers because we are focused on the character making decisions, which if you go to writing classes, that's like the number one rule is that your protagonist should protag. They need to be making choices that matter. And so that focus on agency shows up in LDS writing.
Yeah, again, I think it's interesting to trace this, not just in the Wax and Wayne books, but I think that the Steelheart trilogy is based on the idea of what happens when you just give people power, just regular, ordinary people power, right? The heralds, just ordinary people until they're endowed with power. Take a scholar like Shallan or just a soldier like Kaladin and just endow them with an element of divinity, right? What will they do with that power? And perhaps there's a little bit, again, as Latter-day Saints, when we receive the gift of the Holy Ghost, are we in some way getting a splinter of God's divinity that allows him to speak to us and act through us and see what we'll do with a little bit of power before he gives us more power?
And when we talk about all these choices and how we're influenced by power or by others, this idea that we need our choices and that, just to step over to Stormlight for a minute, the reason that the Spren need the humans isn't because there's really anything great about humans, right? You look at the Spren and they're doing fine on their own. Humans, they're complicated and messy and problematic and mean to each other, but they can progress and the Spren can't. And that's the element that the Spren don't have, that it's worth dealing with the really awful, terrible, messy things that are happening on Roshar. It's worth risking themselves for that hope of progression, and that's what agency brings to the table, that even though you're affecting other people's choices, you get to move somewhere, which again brings us back to the apotheosis, that we have this idea that you can progress all the way to godhood, and we actually see that in a number of different places throughout the Cosmere. And one question I thought we should talk about in terms of agency and needing choices is that from what I've read in Sanderson's corpus, everyone up to this point looks at the original shattering of Ad Nauseam as a bad thing, right? It was a thing that went wrong that caused all the problems. And I really hope we're gonna find out that it's like the Spren sacrifice that Ad Nauseam realized it, we're doing fine on our own, but there's nowhere to go from here. We have to have a fall, we have to have a shattering, we have to break something down in order to bring it back together in a progressive way.
I like that a lot. I actually hadn't thought of that. I have a theory that somehow all the different shards are related to a list somewhere of attributes of Christ. I'm pretty sure. I'm gonna find it someday and write a thesis on it. But yeah, I like that idea of the shattering as a fall.
That's just another kind of quick nod to Latter-day Saint thought, is both Latter-day Saint kind of history and the history of the Cosmere both begin with a war in heaven, right, that then filters down into other worlds. And I do think it's nice that we're in the Yolen room, which is essentially the Kolob of the Cosmere.
Absolutely. I think another thing that we should talk about if we're doing the Wax and Wane books is the idea of free will, especially in the first book, Alloy of Law. There's a lot of talk about whether we are God's puppets, whether we're forced to act the way that we do, or whether we have actually the free will to make choices. I think that's something that LDS theology has pretty strong opinions on. I'm trying to remember that seminary video talking about what different elements you need for free will. Does anybody remember that? Oh yeah, pull it out. There's a list, right?
Yeah.
So in 2 Nephi 2, Lehi lays out four things you need for agency to function. A law must be given, you must have sufficient instruction, there must be opposition in all things, and finally, there must be enticement.
Interesting. So we can think about that. So we've got a law set down. Harmony acts on principles of law. I was noticing when I was rereading the Wax and Wane books, I think it's twice that Wax says he just wants the freedom to know what is right, and it would be easy to act on it. And that's where he's having a hard time, is that everything is complicated. It's not always clear what is right and what is wrong, even though he's trying to act on those right principles. That's interesting from that context.
If I'm thinking of the same one, that's the conversation he has with his grandmother in the prologue. And her reaction is, what are you talking about? It's easy. There are obvious answers. And that's the problem he has with the terrorist people. Everything is too clear. And everything that he deals with is so much more messy, and the complications and the gray areas and the difficulties. And I think that's, again, that's part of the free will problem of how many of your choices are actually you choosing. And we can bring Maracy into this with the sociological elements, that she's going to give you all these statistics that people don't actually make choices. They live by inertia. They're in a path and they're with everybody else on that path, and they just keep going along that path. And that does tend to be a lot of the way we see people around us doing it. And so then the instinct is, okay, we have to buck the system, right? I have to make my own choices, which means by default, I have to choose something opposite of the path I'm on, just the generic culture I inherited. And then you think, wait, is that actually a choice either? Maracy loves that because that's where Wax comes in, and that's where you have these kind of extraordinary people and characters. But then you also have to ask, how much of a choice is that when all you're doing is picking the opposite so that you can have something different? When, you know, in truth, are either your own decision? And like I said, that's kind of a problem with Harmony.
I actually read Terrell Givens recently, like a month ago, put out a book with his son, Nathaniel Givens, called Into the Headwinds, Why Belief Has Always Been Hard and Still Is. And it is very different from anything you've ever read from Terrell Givens. I'm writing a review of it for Dialogue, but I called it Freakonomic style theology, because in it, they talk about all of the new sociology and the stuff Maracy is interested in, the neuroscience that says, we don't understand what we believe. We make up our reasons after we've acted, right? The elephant is the way we act by instinct, and then we have a writer who makes up reasons why we are doing what we're doing, but we really are acting on instinct. And he talks about how do we still have faith when we see these things and we know that we don't know what we really believe. And part of their solution to this problem, how do you have faith when you see all these sociological things and there's so much arguing for determinism of our behavior? And their solution was costly choices. We know that we have faith when we make costly choices that are in that direction. So their example in the book was paying tithing is a sacrifice. And making sacrifices shows what we believe. And we kind of see the same feeling anyway in the Wax and Wayne books that he has to make costly choices and he kills his wife twice. That's a pretty hard decision that he's made to follow justice and to act on Harmony's behalf even though he doesn't agree with Harmony all the time.
That reminds me of a chapter, everything goes back to the book Mormon for me, but Alma 20, right, this beautiful soliloquy Alma has where he's just come out of Ammonihah, he sees these women and children burned, and you get the sense that he's got a little bit of perhaps PTSD or something. He says, oh, that I were an angel, and I could go and I could just help everyone, and I could just get rid of all this evil, and I could make everything work the way I think it should work, but I can't do that, because that's not the way God wants it to be done. And so we're just stuck. Free will can be both, again, good thing and a bad thing. Good thing because it allows me to do what I want to do, but a bad thing because it means that bad things can happen.
And I think you also see that with Wax and 100 Lives, right? With Miles, that Miles didn't decide he didn't like law and justice. He decided the law and justice he was fighting for wasn't significant. It wasn't substantial enough. It wasn't the right one. It was so small scale, it didn't actually give anyone more choices. And so he teams up with the people who said, hey, these are the guys that are going to change things. They're going to open this up. We're going to make more agency out of this. And you have this great foil between which agency is the right agency. Are you going to go with Harmony and his laws? Are you going to go with what he says is probably what he kind of mostly not infallible, but at least knows and has a balance of ruin and preservation? Or are you going to trust someone else who says, I can give you a lot more choices, and those choices include power and freedom in the type that you think you want?
It gets really interesting because Harmony says he can intervene with Bleeder because, well, he puts it as, let's see, where do I have that quote at? She opened herself up for my intervention. But then he's talking about Spook's book and says, I wish he hadn't done that, but I couldn't forbid it. And so it seems like people yield part of their free will, part of their agency through making agreements with deity, right? Again, something else Latter-day Saints could appreciate.
Mm. Which makes you wonder, so do we all need a spike? Do we all need a hemorrhagic earring? You know, dialogic and revelation with God sounds like a good thing to me, until it costs you something.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me of one of the kind of the Mormon hat tips I felt like from the first series was this idea that ruin can only speak to people and can't hear their thoughts. That's it falls into the LDS conception of Satan, right? That Satan can put thoughts into your head, but he can't read your thoughts. So he can tell you things, but he can't tell what you're thinking and what you believe about that. So that one just stood out to me. I was like, Brandon totally ripped that off from I don't think that's a very common belief in other denominations. I think that's ours. I know Quainly wants to talk about one of the things that I have seen a lot in Brandon's books is, I think everybody has noticed, he has a lot of arranged marriages. And we don't have an arranged marriage culture in Mormonism, but I feel like we share a lot with cultures that have arranged marriage cultures. I've been watching Indian Matchmaking on Netflix, which is super fun. If you haven't watched it, it's all the drama. It's great. But just this culture where dating is very high pressure, right? That is an arranged marriage where you are immediately thinking about getting married rather than just hanging out with someone you enjoy. It's a very high commitment from the beginning. And that reminds me a lot of Mormon dating culture. Any thoughts?
I think some of that stems from that quote that any worthy young man and any worthy woman can make a relationship work. And so from the beginning, if things are going well, you don't really take the time to test it out and see, because there's the idea that, like, oh, you can just make it work. And so I think that has echoes of arranged marriages in that, because you assume this is the correct relationship according to your family, according to your circumstances, according to what's going to benefit both parties the most. And you do see people jumping in LDS culture to relationships really early and committing to them really early because of the idea that you can just have love grow as you go.
And it's interesting that all of the arranged marriages in Brandon's books have worked out great. Like, they really have, and especially Steris in here. Like, I know most of us, I didn't like Steris in the first book, I have to admit, but like by book three, I'm totally on board because I'm a spreadsheet woman myself. And I was like, oh, they're working on their spreadsheets together. It's so romantic. I love it. So I found it really interesting. Just this focus on committed relationships rather than more of a casual dating atmosphere, which you get in a lot of books nowadays, a lot of fantasy books, I feel like is a lot more, there's not a ton of marriage, I feel like, unless it is a romance book disguised as a fantasy book.
When Nick was reading Alloy of Law, he actually turned to me and said, so, Steris, is that really who she is? And my response was, yeah, that really is who she is. But by book three, you're going to love her. She's fantastic. Not because she's going to change, but because you find out why it matters that she is the way she is. And I do love that.
And just for the record, by the advance of Morning, she was my favorite.
And with arranged marriages, we're back to this question of choice, right? Theoretically, you can choose anyone you want to marry as long as they're geographically close enough that you can get to know them, or they are on the same TikTok, Discord, some social media that you can find them. And yet, even if you have all your options open, the most important choices you make, you cannot possibly know the ramifications of before you make them. There's no such thing as an informed decision on something like baptism or marriage or temple attendance, or because you can't have the information necessary because it hasn't happened yet. You don't know what it means to have a child before you decide to have a child. And those are the decisions that absolutely shape, control, and determine your life that you can't, even if you're the one making them, you can't make them based on data. You don't have it. You can only make them based on faith. And I think a lot of that comes back to this idea of, why do you trust God? And what's the benefit of it? Which is this exploration that you're talking about, Terrell Givens, that what's the value of having faith? Well, one character said, who else you got? You don't have the information. You can't have the information. God at least has the information. And if you're in a good tradition, he cares about you enough to give you the information that you actually need, whether or not you like it, whether or not, you know, you are wax and you hate harmony to hide the fact that you hate yourself until the ends of bands of mourning. And harmony asks him, how long are you going to hate yourself for that? And he walks him through, if you'd actually had the information, if you knew the future, this is what you wanted. But I couldn't give you the information. I couldn't give you the chance to make a choice because you couldn't possibly make that choice for yourself beforehand. You could only see it afterward. And that's where the faith aspect comes in.
Yeah, I think Brandon does something really interesting with faith, particularly at the ends of the Band of Mourning, right, when he's talking to Wax and they see the light, when Marisi finds the Bands of Mourning, right? And Wax asks him what that is, what's that light? And he says, trust. And you get the sense that faith for Brandon isn't just our trust in God, it's God's trust in us.
That's one thing that I also love. If you look, when you talk about grace and love, the idea that the basis of a testimony is love. You have an experience, you have a witness, you have something that means something to you. And it almost always revolves around the idea of you realize God matters and you matter to God. And that creates a relationship. We don't love God because life is good and it's easy. In fact, one of my favorite moments somewhere in Stormlight is, I don't remember who says it, but the idea that too many people go to religion hoping it'll make their life better, but they actually need to go to religion because it makes themselves better. And this idea that we don't love God because life is easy or good or cheap or wonderful. We love God because he loved us first. And our love is actually returning a grace as we receive it. And I like that throughout the book, that we have faith in God, not just because we are willing to trust him, but because we believe he was willing to trust us too.
So another thing, this is in the DNC, but the idea that prophets are replaceable, right? Foreordination, but choice. So when those two concepts combine, Wax is being molded as Harmony's sword, as his prophet, but is Wax ultimately replaceable if he makes choices that choose to reject that? And we do see that, like, Harmony is working really hard on Marcy as well. So would she be the replacement if Wax was unwilling? So I find that really interesting.
Well, and going back to Lessie's death at the beginning, he found another way to get Wax where he needed to be because he wasn't going in that direction himself.
Yeah, it's true. Any other thoughts? Is there anything else we haven't gotten to that we should talk about?
We didn't do dialogic revelation, okay. Though we kind of on him.
Just one thing, just the overarching kind of theme of the series is this idea of revelation, right? And again, nod to Terrell Givens about 20 years ago. He wrote a book called By the Hand of Mormon, where he talked about what he called dialogic revelation, which is the idea that for a lot of other cultures, particularly in the Old Testament, revelation is God tells a prophet, and the prophet tells the people, thus saith the Lord. But one of the things that makes the Book of Mormon and Latter-day Saint culture unique is, for us, revelation is a dialogue. It's not a pronouncement. When we talk about revelation, it's almost as if we're talking about having a conversation with God. The Spirit spoke to me. God nudged me, right? And then I responded, then he responded to me. Okay, it is this ongoing dialogue, and that explicitly, all the way through Wax's relationship with Harmony, it's a dialogue. They ask each other questions, they give answers, right? Build on what each other has to say in a way that is uniquely Latter-day Saint.
In fact, that same carriage scene, you notice that the scenes we're pulling from the most are Harmony talking to Wax in the carriage and Harmony talking to Wax in the afterlife, right? Because it's that element of the dialogic revelation that gives us so much of this kind of the existential meaning of who you are and what you are. But my favorite moment in the carriage is actually when Wax complains and says, "You're not being very helpful." And Harmony's response is, "So ask better questions." And you look at 1 Nephi 11, the reason Nephi gets 4 chapters of vision, where his father got 1, not quite a whole chapter, and Nephi gets 4, he starts asking questions and he starts looking and then he starts answering questions. The angel asks and he's, "So I don't know everything, but I know God loves his children. Can you do something with that?" Right? Help me out with that. And this idea that your own progression is a willingness of God to interact with you in all of your multiplicity of fallibilities, right? And point out your fallibilities to you and tell you, you need to ask better questions if you want better answers.
And you can see the same as Brother Jared in Ether 2 and 3, right? Brother Jared has questions, but the Lord gives him essentially 3 different answers to those. And well, one hand, you got to trust me. On another hand, here's instructions. On another hand, what do you think I should do? And it's responding appropriately to that dialogue, to those questions, that allows that conversation to continue.
Okay, we've pretty much done everything we've prepared for. Does anyone have any questions or things we didn't hit on that you want us to talk about? So for the recording, I'm going to repeat that. But the scene at the end where Sazed takes up both Harmony and Preservation and realizes that the truth he was looking for is not in one religion but scattered through many religions. This is definitely something that we believe in the LDS faith, is that there's truth everywhere, right? And bring the truth that you have and we'll add to it. And all truth is encompassed in our church.
And I also love that example because he spends the entire third book looking for the true church, right? And he rejects every single one of them. And he rejects the survivor church first because he knew Kelsier and he knew it was the Chondra appearing after the resurrection, right? And he gets to the end and he realizes that while he was looking for truth with a capital T, he needed everything. Everything had truth with a lowercase t. And it wasn't until he himself was willing to hold it all that he actually ascended, and he used that information to reconstruct the world, to pull it out of its fallen state into a better state. In fact, I love the fact that he uses the information from Trell. He uses the star charts from the Trell religion to get Scadrial in the right spot again. And I think that's fabulous. And the idea that you have to construct what meaning is by being willing to find it everywhere. And then as Harmony's been doing this for 300 years, he's got a pretty good idea now, but he's still working on the whole, he's ascended, the apotheosis is complete, but that doesn't mean his progression is complete. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, to me, Sazed is a great stand-in for Joseph Smith, right? Somebody who's searching for the truth, frustrated with inconsistencies, and then finally finds it. And Joseph himself even said, if the Baptists have the truth, we seek it. If the Methodists have the truth, we want it. Richard Bushman said, Joseph Smith has a green thumb. He can take little bits and pieces from different things and turn them into full-out institutions. He has that gift, and Sazed seems to have that gift as well.
So we should shout out to so many of the revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants come because he's reading the Bible. And that green thumb aspect, that if you're willing to give God a chance, if you're willing to read the scripture he has, even if you've been doing the Old Testament and you're getting a little worn out with the Old Testament.
But We're all there.
I mean, don't get me wrong, because the whole marriage metaphors in Hosea and Isaiah, like, all of the fantastic. But there's a lot in that text that is difficult to deal with. There's a lot that you have to look at. If I'm going to really take this seriously, I have to take seriously that there are things in here that I don't know what to do with. And the fact that that's actually the pattern is not to just assume it's okay because it's in there, but to read it and say, can God explain to me what I'm supposed to do with this? Because it's actually complicated and I'm not sure. And that was Sazed's journey through his religions and Joseph Smith's journey kind of through the Bible and this dialogic revelation. Let God teach you, give him the chance to tell you what matters and why it matters and what you should do.
Fantastic. Okay, we're gonna wrap it up. Kweli, where can people follow you, follow your writing journey?
Nothing published yet, but I recently created a Facebook page. It's called Rue Atherton Writes. That's going to be my pen name. So that's where you can find me, Rue Atherton Writes on Facebook.
And we'll put that link in the show notes. Nick, where can people find some of your work? I know there was a recent article on the From the Desk blog of your presentation about the Way of Kings could have saved the Nephites. Give us a spin for that.
Well, for the seven people out there listening who might be interested in the Bible and the Book of Mormon, you can track down my stuff on Religious Studies Center's website. But yeah, the one most recently, I presented the Book of Mormon Studies Association conference asking if Brandon intentionally modeled King Benjamin after the Way of Kings. Right, what would the impact then be if, say, the Nephites had found the Way of Kings rather than the Jaredite record? And just play a little bit with hypothetical history.
All right. Do you have anything to share? Okay. And you can follow my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com. And you can follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Subscribe on the major podcast platforms. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. We'll see you next time.